Welcome to our second lesson in the book of Daniel. I've entitled it, Why Daniel Went to Babylon. And what we'll do, as we've done in previous studies, is we'll take three salient slides from the last lesson, look at them in a very cursory fashion to get ourselves back up to speed and prepare our minds for this current lesson, and then we will close looking at three salient points of this lesson to reinforce those teaching points. Now remember, the early Iron Age, 1200 to 800 BC, was a struggle with change. We had the Late Bronze Age collapse, and you had a Dark Ages that lasted for a couple hundred years or so. And in this process of change, Israel came into existence. There was a power vacuum. Almost every great Bronze Age kingdom had vanished, except for Egypt and Assyria, and they were greatly weakened. And it's called the Bronze Age because, of course, their weapons and tools were made out of bronze, copper and tin, ratio of 10 to 1. But these were not easily found everywhere. They were in relatively, few deposits. Copper basically was mined from and on the island of Cyprus, and tin came from a large area in Afghanistan. So you need these large centralized empires to engage in trade with each other, protect the trade routes, and keep the materials flowing. But as we saw, these large centralized empires were not very adaptable, especially if they had multiple disasters striking them at one time, which it looks like they did. And Israel really was punished and protected. I mean, Judah's blessing was the captivity. And we know that Israel was, the northern kingdom was taken off into captivity, at least the upper echelon, around 722 BC by Assyria. And then a short time later, 100 years or so, Assyria was defeated by Babylon. And it was Babylon who led Judah off into captivity as they were stretching their muscles and securing the Levant so that they were taking it away from Egypt, so to speak. But as the Iron Age began, the Gentiles were again forming these strong nations, and God both protected and punished his people. So punishing them, removing them out of the Levant area, and taking them away in three successive waves, except for the very poor, which stayed in the land. It was literally taking them out of harm's way, while at the same time, he was punishing them, taking them back to where they came from because of their idolatry. Because God says, you want idolatry? This is where you came from, idolatry, right from this area. So let's just go back there and you can have your fill of it. Because Romans chapter 1, and God gave them up. And he gave them up to their idolatry. Now, he wasn't going to let them go completely as he had the northern kingdom because of the Davidic covenant. He had a promise to David, he made a covenant, that he'd always have someone to sit on the throne as long as they were an independent entity. When they came back from the captivity, obviously they were never an independent political entity again. In Daniel, he's faithfulness in the midst of unfaithfulness. And so, one of the two major points that I wanted to drive home is that Satan is going to be building these strong, aggressive governments. And they are going to stretch out and consolidate and grow, each one greater than the next, by becoming more and more debased. Because that's what sin does. It's violent and it's degrading. So it debases you. And we know that in the Iron Age, it coincided with the Axial Age, and we've used that term in other lessons. The Axial Age is where mankind underwent a fundamental shift in understanding morality. It became a more of a personal morality. Before, in the Bronze Age, you were a member of your society, and that was going to get you into wherever you were supposed to go, by and large. That's how it worked. But since God gave the Jews the moral law, and they sat astride the Levant and the trade routes, and had great influence, especially under Solomon, such that the knowledge of his wisdom spread far and wide, and also of his God. So that this percolated throughout those kingdoms that came in contact with Judaism. And it began to affect them such that it was no longer sufficient just to be a member of society. Now you had a personal accountability for right and wrong. And thus, we see that God's moral law influenced nations that encountered the Jews. And of course, our example there was the Queen of Sheba. And during this period, the Axial Age, in the Iron Age, God begins revealing his Messiah who will come to save with his new covenant. It is basically through the writing prophets, major and minor, and that's just based on the thickness of their books. God was revealing by stages Messiah and the characteristics of Messiah. But he wasn't differentiating between the first coming and the second coming. And so the Jews were confused. And that's okay, because a lot of Christians are still confused over eschatology. Now, Daniel was taken from his home, his nation, and his temple, and thrust into the very heart of unfaithfulness. And yet Daniel consistently demonstrated his faithfulness in the face of that unfaithfulness or faithlessness. And his testimony condemns both the Jews of his day who embraced Babylonian culture and those who returned but turned Judaism into a business of greed. Daniel's message: Satan's faithless new world order defeated by Christ's faithful gospel. Now the Jews disobeyed despite God's warning of dysphoria. And they had this warning from the very beginning. And he kept repeating this warning to the Jews of their impending doom when they prove themselves unfaithful. I mean, that is the whole purpose of Deuteronomy chapters 27 and 28. You'll stand on Mount Ebal, these six tribes, and these six tribes will stand on Mount Gerizim when you went in the promised land, and the priest would read the law, and the blessings would be shouted out by this group, and the cursings for rejecting God and chasing idolatry and all this would then be echoed by this group to drive home the message time after time that if you're not paying attention, you will not stay in the land. And let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 47 down through 51. And because you did not serve the Lord your God with joyfulness and gladness of heart because of the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies whom the Lord will send against you, and hunger and thirst and nakedness and lacking everything. And he will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar away, from the end of the earth, swooping down like the eagle, a nation whose language you do not understand. A hard-faced nation who shall not respect the old or show mercy to the young. And that was the Babylonians. And this is why, with the gift of tongues in the early days of the church, it was not only an authentication of the gospel message, but it was also a condemnation to the Jews. They would have recalled to mind, or should have recalled to mind, these verses in Deuteronomy. A nation whose language you do not understand. Now, they would have had that near-term example in with Babylon taking them off into captivity. But also, they were going to have that experience because they had killed Messiah. They had rejected Messiah. And then they were going to be driven out of the land by the Romans. And the Romans are very hard. And a language that they did not understand. So God had warned them not to return to Egypt for horses, because horses were the late Bronze Age military technology of the day, chariots. Solomon ignored these warnings, becoming an arms dealer. And you have to go to 1 Kings chapter 10, and we'll go there because we're going to spend a lot of time in 1 Kings. And we'll go down to verse 26. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Ku, and the king's traders received them from Ku at a price. The trade would be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. And so through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. In other words, Solomon was an arms dealer. That was one of the ways he got rich. But God had told them in Deuteronomy 17, let's flip back there, and let's read 16 and 17. And here, Moses, God through Moses, is talking about what a king should not do. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. As the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excess of silver and gold. And yet, when you go back to 1 Kings 10, verse 27, and the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and he made cedar as plentiful as a sycamore of Shephelah. And so, basically, Solomon the wise dude violated everything that God told him not to do. God had warned him not to go to Egypt for wives. Solomon had an Egyptian wife. Now, it's a treaty wife. But he built her a house for herself. He built her a place of worship for herself, right in Jerusalem, and then in the high places. And he did so for all of his treaty wives. That's how treaties were ratified in those days. God told him not to amass many riches. Obviously, you just read Solomon did. In fact, bronze, they didn't even count. It was so common. And same way with silver. And gold was plentiful to boot. So Solomon led Judah into disobedience despite this gift of wisdom spoken of in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Where God appeared to Solomon in a dream and says, what do you want? And Solomon says, well, I got land, I got king. How about wisdom? If I got wisdom, I can get everything else. God says, okay. And we'll give you everything else. But he should have been wise in the word of God. Instead, he asked for wisdom to rule the people. He wanted political wisdom. That's what he got. Not godly wisdom. Never confused the two. That's why you read the book of Ecclesiastes. His heart was turned away. He was not wise in the things of God. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, you see that now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon clung to those in love. He had 700 wives, who were princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David, his father. You see? This is the problem here. Solomon got enamored with the amount of attention that he was getting. He had great wealth, he had great wisdom, but guess what? He had great pride. He just couldn't control himself. And so his heart turned from God to idolatry, legitimizing sins in Israel. You see, this is what happened, is that, go down to verse 6 in 1 Kings 11. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. And he built all these places for his foreign wives, legitimizing all this idolatry. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice and you have not kept my covenant with my statutes, I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant, Yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen." See, the Hebrews were the least of all people. And God deliberately chose them because they were the least of all people. We read this in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 7. And in 1 Corinthians 1, 26 through 29, God said he uses the small things, the foolish things, to confound the wise, the strong, the rulers. And there are not many smart, not many rich, and not many powerful that are chosen, because you get confused. You think you're doing it. There's a whole point with this free will or Armenian thing here. Yeah, it is prideful. I saved myself. No, Christ saved me, but I made the decision. I was smart enough to know it. Whereas Scripture does say you were born blind and dead in your sins, and God had to make you alive spiritually, to be able to, and once you did that, once he made you alive, once he took the scales off your eyes, of course you believed. Of course you agreed. But God had to do that first. And God chose you. That was the whole point of our studies in Romans 9, 10, and 11. So Israel, Judah, talking about the two kingdoms, became confused, thinking they were able to compete with Satan's strong forces rather than rest in the Lord. And it's a lesson that still has not been learned today, and many Christians still have not learned that lesson today. God had shown them through their history that his glory was manifested through their weaknesses. Their strength led to pride in sin. Let's go to Proverbs. And we'll go to chapter 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. In the same way in 1 Corinthians 10, 12. It talks about how your pride sets you up to fall. Therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. If you think that you're standing, that you're doing, that it's all about you and your strength, you have already lost the battle. You have lost the war. It is not your strength. But Solomon got confused. He had no wars. He had this huge army. He had this great military tech, chariots, which were not even suited to be used in most Israeli terrain. There's only a very few places where you can use a chariot. Just be very flat, very smooth. And you just have to get them to that battlefield. And, you know, if you're going over mountains and hilly and rough and rocky terrain, chariots are going to be beat to death before they ever get into battle. These were not strong structures. These were not tanks. These were very, very light vehicles, easily broken. And see, their history was always about this lesson being driven home to them. See, Gideon was the least of all men to lead the people, but he was chosen of God. Then he became prideful, leading them into sin. Everyone familiar with the Bible account in Judges there, Judges chapter 7, where God called Gideon least of all folk, and Gideon was threshing his grain in secret. He was afraid of the people around him. And God said, call these people, and you know, stories where lots of tests of faith and all this. You know, and asking for signs is not a demonstration of your faith. It's a demonstration of your lack of faith. If you have to ask for a sign, it demonstrates that you do not believe. It's actually a slap in your face. You're literally condemning yourself when you ask for a sign. And yet, after Gideon agreed to be used of God and he called the people, God says, no, you got too many folk. And so he whittled them down until he had 300. He had thousands. God says, whoa, that is way too many. You guys be getting prideful, thinking you'd doing this. And they did anyway. And how about David? David was a small teen. He was a short guy. He was a small teen facing giant Goliath. And Goliath means splendid. And yet God gave David victory. But later in his pride, he publicly sinned with Bathsheba and murdered her husband, Uriah, with impunity. Except God would not let it go. That's one of the reasons we know the Bible is true. God does not let these things go. Now, if you're following along in the handout, and I hope you are, we have this little map here showing us Daniel's world. And, of course, you see the Mesopotamia area. You see the Empire of Babylon there, and Assyria up there, and if you look at that, you'll see the battles they have. If you go across the top and then down, you will see the Levant area with Aram, Ammon, Judah, Moab, Edom. Notice how tiny Judah actually is. They were not even considered much of a nation. So the regional conflicts reshaped Daniel's world. The Medes, Babylonians allied to destroy Assyria. And Assyria lasted, 1,000, 1,500 years? And then they were destroyed almost overnight. Vanished, never to rise again. Egypt reasserted hegemony in the Levant. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Judah intrudes without any guidance from God. And here's the small guy getting involved with the big guy stuff. And without permission from God. Yet he thought, the king thought he was doing God's will, I'm sure. Babylon battles Egypt to win Levant hegemony. And Judah enters captivity. So here's the broad brush of what it is we're going to be looking at in this particular lesson, so that we can understand why Judah got into this fix and see the world as Daniel knew the world. So God finishes with Assyria, and he brings in the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. They go by both names. Now, the Medes were actually, if you look on that map again, you'll see that Media is north of the mountains, into the mountains. They were a rough folk. And they harassed Assyria for a millennia before coalescing into a nation, into an empire. And thus, that's why they were able to ally with the Babylonians to go and take out their old enemy, the Assyrians. Neither one alone was probably powerful enough, even though Assyria was having major conflict and rebellions internally at the time. And so it's the Medes and Babylonians together that besiege Nineveh and eventually take it and sack it, and they form an alliance. However, a remnant of Assyria's army escapes. They escape to Canaan, and ask Egypt for help when pursued by Nebuchadnezzar, who was crowned prince at this time. And 2 years later, Nebuchadnezzar pursued them again, kicked them out of Keron, and these people were forced to flee to Carchemish, also in the north area, north of the Levant. And why this is important is because these Assyrians asked Egypt for help. Now, the old Pharaoh, he didn't care. He's old. I don't want to go out and live in the field anymore. It's not going to help me. I'm not going to get much out of it. And so that's why Egypt did not come to the help at Qumran. But between Qumran and Carchemish, when the Assyrians asked for help again, that old Pharaoh died. And his son, young guy, ascends to the throne. And he says, I need to kick butt and get glory. Because that's what kings and presidents do. Kick butt, get glory. No matter what it costs everyone else. Now his name was Necho II, which in the scriptures is just called Necho. And he agrees to help this Assyrian army, this tiny, tiny, tiny remnant of Assyria's army that's left, because Assyria as an empire is just gone, it's vanished. Its territory has been absorbed by Babylon and the Medes. But he expects to get the Levant as payment. And so Necho does defeat Nebuchadnezzar at the first battle of Carchemish. And Necho and Nebuchadnezzar war at Carchemish 3 years later. But now Necho loses. After being crowned king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar seeks to secure the Levant, and he campaigns over there multiple times. See, his dad dies, and we'll go into more detail in that in just a few moments. But Judah aligns with Egypt despite Jeremiah's warning to accept captivity. But why did they do that? Did not God tell them never to go to Egypt? He said, and yet here they are. And Jeremiah warns them multiple times throughout his writings, don't go to Egypt. And where do they go? They go to Egypt. And guess what? Eventually Nebuchadnezzar is going to go to Egypt. Now Hezekiah, let's look at two or three of these kings that are leading up to this captivity that is going to occur. Now, Hezekiah is just a good king gone prideful. There are very few good kings. There are none in the north in Israel, and there are relatively few in the south in Judah. But Hezekiah was one of those relatively good kings. Ruled 715 to 686 BC, when Assyria and Egypt were both asserting hegemony over the Levant and threatening minor kingdoms with destruction for tribute and allegiance. And so Egypt would threaten you and demonstrate outside your walls until you give them tribute, and then they go away, and then Assyria would come in and do the same thing. And basically it was extortion, just to get tribute and money off of you. So it was Sennacherib in 705 to 681 BC threatened Jerusalem's destruction. This is in Isaiah 36. And Hezekiah turns to Isaiah for God's guidance. Because there ain't no way he beaten this army. It did way too big. Isaiah said Jerusalem will not be touched, but Sennacherib would return to Nineveh and die. And guess what? In Isaiah 37, Sennacherib returned to Nineveh and he died. It's amazing how that happens. And it did something to Hezekiah. He had come this close seeing death in the face. Well, later on in Isaiah 38, Hezekiah gets an infection. God tells Isaiah, go talk to Hezekiah, tell him he's going to die. Okay, so Isaiah goes, talks to Hezekiah, you're going to die. God said, you're going to die. Put your affairs in order because you're going to die. And Isaiah leaves. Before Isaiah leaves the palace area, Hezekiah is on his bed, whining and carrying on. Probably the first time he's prayed in a while. Asked God, don't kill me. Let me live. Let me live. And God tells Isaiah, turn around, go back. Tell him he'll live. He'll live a few years, he'll be fine. But it was not going to be fine. And so Isaiah made a poultice, put it on Hezekiah's infection, and it cleared up. And this Babylonian king of the city of Babylon, it wasn't an empire yet, it was just a city. And they were constantly warring with Assyria. And sometimes Assyria would put their own puppet on the throne. Sometimes the Babylonians would throw them off and they'd be independent for a while, a short time or whatever. This is one of the times when they're kind of independent-ish. And Merodach-Baladan, king of Babylon, sends an envoy with gifts celebrating the recovery of Hezekiah. Now we need to be aware of the adage of beware of gifts, of Greeks bearing gifts, reference to the horse, Trojan horse. And in Isaiah 39, we see that Hezekiah is just so overwhelmed that this important king thinks he's important enough to send me gifts and an envoy and to wish me the better, and he did the Solomon thing. He got prideful, he got stupid. And he showed him all his secret treasures in the temple and everything. And they took notes. Because they're going to be coming back this way again. And Isaiah confronted Hezekiah and said, what'd you tell them? What'd you show them? Well, guess what? They're going to come back and get those. But not in your lifetime. And Hezekiah says, I don't care then. Not my problem then. I will have peace. See how prideful and self-centered he became? He was going to die. He was going to go be with God. And he whined and carried on. And then he just did stupid stuff. For him, and for Judah, it would have been better if he had died. But when he did die, the next king was Manasseh. And Manasseh, he was a bad king. A real bad king. In fact, so much so that it says several times in the Kings and the Chronicles that for the sins of Manasseh, they got carried off into captivity. Because he caused Judah to sin greatly. But guess what? Assyria came toward the end of his 50-year reign, or somewhere in there, toward the latter part of his reign, and he reigned 50 years, defeated him and carried him off to Babylon, which now was under the control of the Assyrians, and kept him there for a while. Didn't torture him. And you begin to think that maybe I'm not as powerful as I once thought I was. And he repented. And he got saved. It helped him. Didn't help Judah much. Because what did he do? Well, people worshiped Baal, the host of heavens, including the sun and the moon on the heights. Asherah was worshipped within the temple. Milcah, prostitution, also within the temple, though God specifically forbade sons and daughters to practice cult prostitution in Deuteronomy 23:17. He sacrificed his son and promoted child sacrifice to Molech. It's where you place your son on the arms of this metal idol. They had a fire inside, so the babies literally were burned to death. You had to be playing these instruments to drown out the screams of the kids as they were literally cooked. He consulted mediums and necromancers, which was forbidden in Leviticus 19:31. And he killed many, probably those who spoke against his practices. Like Isaiah. According to Jewish legend, he put Isaiah in a tree trunk and sawed him in half. And Hebrews 11 talks about those who were sawn asunder. So he may have been referencing back to Manasseh and Isaiah and all those who believed God and spoke out against him died horribly. And his repentance displayed God's grace, but it really didn't change Judah's disposition toward idolatry. Now we have Josiah. And he's just a good king gone just stupid. This was a great king in that he instituted Deuteronomic reforms, even having the law read to him as required. You go to Deuteronomy 17:18-20, and you'll see where the king was supposed to be given a copy of the law to read. He's supposed to be given a copy of the Old Testament, such as it was whenever he reigned. It wasn't all completed. And read it, you know, especially the Pentateuch. Be familiar with that law. Be familiar with God's justice. Be uncorruptible. Turn to God. Well, he did this. He actually had the law read to him. In 2 Kings 22, verses 1 and 2. And Josiah restored the Passover, which had not been fully performed since the days of the judges, to include the days of David and Solomon. Now, that's just a straight slap in the face, David and Solomon, that they did not represent or practice the Pesach, the Passover, I say we're supposed to. But there were several other things that the Jews did not do that they were supposed to. So there's Jubilee and the Tabernacles. And this will become evident as we go through Daniel. I mean, it's going to be very specific and very important when we get there. His reforms were coupled with zeal, but not good hermeneutics. I mean, it's not enough to have a lot of excitement. It's not enough to have a lot of enthusiasm. You have to have good hermeneutics. You have to understand the scriptures. You cannot just sit there and listen to somebody else teach you and say, okay, that was interesting, I enjoyed that, and then never study it for yourself. It is not yours yet. And guess what? As Necho II was going from Egypt to Carchemish the first time, he's traveling through the Levant, because that's how you get there. And Josiah goes out to the valley of Megiddo to obstruct him. And Necho told him and said, what in the world are you doing? I have no quarrel with you this day. Move aside. Nope. He wouldn't do that. I don't know. Perhaps Josiah saw himself as just a great crusader for God. This Egyptian, we weren't supposed to go to Egypt, and Egypt has come to us, and we just need to stand firm in the faith and stand against them. And in fact, if you go to 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 20 through 27, you read an account of this, where Necho sent envoys to him and said, what have we got to do with each other? I'm not coming against you this day, but against the house with which I am at war. And God has commanded me to hurry. Cease opposing God who is with me, lest he destroy you. Now he did not listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God, but came to fight in the plain of Megiddo. And he died. He got shot. He got taken to Jerusalem, got badly wounded, and he died. Now they mourned for him, and Jeremiah also mourned for him. But he had no business being there. And this was really going to be the last solid king that they have. Because what happens after the Battle of Carchemish, Necho, who had beat Nebuchadnezzar, now he's got a lot of pride, and he's coming back through the Levant, and he's collecting tribute. And he remembers this Judah. And he's going to fix this. Evidently, the kings here are not very smart and are not very respectful. And so what he does is he takes and puts his own king on the throne of Judah, one who's going to be respectful. And Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of of Josiah, his father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. And he took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. And Jehoiakim, K-I-M, gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, because that's what you had to do. You had to pay tribute. That's why you have vassal kingdoms. And so, if he had not gone out against Necho, probably would not have had a puppet king on the throne. At least not just yet. But it's going to be coming anyway. Now, at the second battle of Carchemish, Necho doesn't do as well. He gets defeated, and Nebuchadnezzar pursues him to Egypt. And so while Necho's retreating, orderly, I hope, back to Egypt, being pursued by Nebuchadnezzar all the way to the border of Egypt, he gets word that his father, Nabopolassar, has died. Because he's no guy, and he stayed in Babylon. Now, the way it works in those days, you had to go back and show yourself and march the idol of Marduk from one place to another in a great procession and do all this. And you had to put down the inevitable rebellions that erupt every time there was a change of kings. And so that's what Nebuchadnezzar was going to do. That's why he didn't pursue Necho right into Egypt. But on the way back, he knows he needs to take tribute. He knows he needs to have something to show for his victory. And since he's not pursuing Necho down into Egypt to raid him and take prisoners and booty and all that, he remembers, or somebody remembered, the riches of Judah. So to present himself as a strong king, he stops at Jerusalem to plunder the city, since the Babylonians remember the riches Hezekiah showed them, and he's going to put them on display in that grand procession. And so by this time, Jehoiakim, K-I-M, died, and his son, Jehoiachin, reigns, and he agrees to become Babylon's vassal. In 2 Kings 24, verses 6 through 9. And not like he has a lot of choice here, because Nebuchadnezzar has this large army, and Judah has almost nothing as an army, and you're like the third king in 3 years, 4 years, something like that. And so after a very short siege, he just opens up and says, okay, not quite. Because the last thing you want to do is keep them waiting on a siege, because once they gain entrance, there will be no mercy. Well, guess what? Nebuchadnezzar carries off the temple treasures, Jehoiachin with his officials and his family, and the military forces stationed in Jerusalem, and many of the nobles and craftsmen. Now, this includes Daniel. Daniel gets taken in this first wave, probably around 605 BC. Jehoiachin's uncle was made king, and his name was changed from Mataniah to Zedekiah. Now, Israel had been warned of captivity by a nation with a strange tongue, and we've already talked about that. The tongues were a sign of coming judgment of God on the Jews. You know, people want to run around and speak tongues today like they got a special blessing from God. But it really had a twofold purpose: to to take the message out to those who didn't have the message in their own language. And there's some indication that the ones who were speaking in tongues, it's not like they understood the language. You needed an interpreter. Like Paul, he spoke, what? He spoke Koine Greek, and he spoke Hebrew or Aramaic, read Hebrew, and might have known Latin. That's not speaking in tongues. He learned those languages. But if he had spoken a language he had never learned, that is a miracle from God. But it doesn't mean that you understand that language, because you didn't learn that language. Because that's why you had to have an interpreter present, because you couldn't interpret what it is you said. And so if you're just standing up in a church speaking and nobody, and you don't know if there's an interpreter present, you shouldn't have been speaking. Because nobody knows what it is you're saying, except for the person it was intended. But if they're not there, there was no point in speaking the tongue to begin with. So if you're in a Greek church and you're speaking, you know, whatever they spoke in Persia, because there was some Persians visiting your church and the Spirit of God came on and you stood up and started speaking Persian, you had to know they were there. Otherwise, what was the whole point of speaking? So when Solomon dedicated the temple, he asked God to hear his people when they were carried into captivity. And if they repented, then God would hear their plea, bringing them back again to Jerusalem, to his temple. 1 Kings 8:46-53. And God warned Solomon that if he and his future descendants sinned, then God would throw away the temple. All would know it occurred because the Jews rejected God. 1 Kings 9:1-9. And God fulfilled his promise, first given through Moses, that he would cast off Jerusalem in response to their continual embracing the world. That was Mount Ebal, the curses. And good or evil, Judah's kings and her people brought this punishment on themselves, proving the need for a Messiah from God, as people will always fail. Daniel, life in Shinar. Now, Shinar just means the country of two rivers. You might as well just say Mesopotamia, because it's Babylonian for the same thing. You say life in Mesopotamia. So the book of Daniel opens with an implied indignity, though tactfully given. It was a common practice today to bring foreign talent into the court, and the Babylonians were very good about this. They had no qualms at all about using talent from captured peoples, using military forces of captured people into their army and stuff. They saw it as strengthening the monarchy. However, to prevent any dreams of dynastic usurpation, the men were made eunuchs, which made them more docile and less inclined to rebellion, because you couldn't produce an heir. Daniel and the other captives were placed under the control of Ashpenaz, chief of the eunuchs. It's probable that the boys, men, were also made the same. It was very common to have eunuchs at work in the palace, not just because of raiding the harem, but because if they had heirs, they would have dreams of being king, which meant that you as king were going to have a very short life. So if you just nipped that in the bud, so to speak, that was less likely to have problems. Nathanael was probably among the sons of the nobles, since there is no hint that he was of the line of David. And Ashpenaz was there to ensure these young men were trained in the Babylonian language and learning, as Nebuchadnezzar would inspect and select them for duties he believed they would be fit to perform. Now, most people don't know the Jewish name of Daniel's faithful friends. We know Daniel's Jewish name. Most people don't know his, the name given to him. He was renamed Belshazzar. But Shadrach, almost everyone knows their Persian names or Babylonian names because of the song. So Shadrach, he was actually Hananiah. Meshach was Mishael, and Abednego was Azariah. Now, these are probably titles and not really names. And we've talked about that in other lessons. And in the Old Testament, most of the time you're not reading a name, you're reading a title. It's telling you something about that person. So it's denoting a difference between the Jewish lives and the current lives in Babylon. So Daniel is, God is my judge, and Belshazzar is Lord of the narrow treasure. Narrow way, the narrow gate. In Matthew 7, 13 through 14. Hananiah, God has favored. Shadrach is a great scribe. Mishael is who is like God. Meshach, guest of the king. Now you were considered a guest. You were slave guest. But you're a guest. You can go anyplace. Not on your own. Because you're a slave. But you're still a guest. And Azariah is Jehovah has helped. And Abednego is slave of Nebo. Or Nabu. Which is the god of writing. And was denounced by Isaiah in Isaiah 46:1. So why were these four young men compliant? Why did they not seek vengeance as the descendants would do under Rome? Well, let's look at Habakkuk. Judgment is coming, live by faith. Habakkuk, which means embrace, because that's what you need to do. You need to embrace this message, and you need to embrace your destiny because the Chaldeans are coming. He was contemporary with Jeremiah, which means whom God has appointed. And he inquired of God how God could bear Judah's sins. That's Habakkuk 1. And of course, God informed Habakkuk that I can't. So I've raised up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to chasten Judah. And Habakkuk was just beside himself. How can you raise up these sinful dogs? And you hear this all the time. How can you use such sinful people? Well, you know something? If God's going to use people, we're all sinners. That's all he's got to use. There are no sinless people. There are only self-righteous people. So God was going to give the people what they wanted. Abrahamic idolatry. Now Habakkuk knew the Babylonians would believe themselves responsible for victory. And in fact, we're going to see this in the book of Daniel. And Habakkuk waited on God to more fully instruct him. And that's where he was writing, the just or the righteous shall live by faith, regardless of their situation. Habakkuk 2, 1 through 4 and Romans 1, 17. God informed him the Chaldeans will answer for their sin and not submitting to God when they heard the truth. And they're going to hear the truth through Jeremiah and through Daniel. And he's specifically talking about what's going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar, who literally will suffer the judgment of God, but the grace of God simultaneously. And we'll talk about that when we get there in the book. Now, Jeremiah, judgment is coming. Do not resist. Stop it. He spent most of his prophetic ministry telling Judah to acquiesce to the coming judgment. God has apportioned to them through Nebuchadnezzar. If Zedekiah had repented and followed God, probably there would have been no further deportations. But Zedekiah, he had to disobey, he had to rebel, he had to join Egypt again, and thus Nebuchadnezzar came back and, of course, carried him away, but also more of the Jews away too. And there was another time. And in Jeremiah 24, you have the vision of the figs. You have a basket of bad figs, and these are those who resist God's judgment. Both those who resist Nebuchadnezzar and those who flee to Egypt. But the basket of good figs are those who go into captivity and do not rebel. They will return. So that's why these young men did not rebel. That's why they were faithful. Not because they loved Babylon, and not because they wanted to eat the good stuff, as we'll see in our next lesson, and just wallow in the goodness of Babylon, but because this was God's will. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft in 1 Samuel. God does not condone rebellion ever. So Jeremiah tells the coalition of rebellious vassal kings that Nebuchadnezzar is guided by God. They were having this meeting there in Jerusalem saying, well, we're all going to cast lots and join Egypt, right? Yeah, we're all going to do this, right? Yeah. Okay. Jeremiah says, don't be doing that. You're not going to win. Do not listen to the lying prophets who speak of victory in Egypt, Jeremiah 27. But many of Judah's wealthy flee to Egypt. And guess what? They be dragging Jeremiah with them against his will and against God's express command, demonstrating their rebellion, Jeremiah 43. And it doesn't really avail them much because, yes, you have a big Jewish community in Alexandria after this. But Nebuchadnezzar does invade at some point Egypt. And so they really didn't escape anything. So in closing, remember, Daniel's world. Look at the map. Become familiar with some of the place names. You'll see them again. Remember, the Jews disobeyed despite God's warning of dysphoria. And he repeated that throughout their history. But it was their kings who tolerated and encouraged their sin. So Israel was warned of captivity by a nation with a strange tongue. And as it got closer, God spoke more clearly about it. And Christians have learned little. Christians always seek to be powerful in the world, and Christendom does too. Well, Christian doctrine was hijacked early on by Christendom. That's the works-based churches, if you want to use that term, that are lost and don't teach the true gospel. But they commit the same errors as Judah. They want to be strong in the world. Catholicism wanted to compete and have political power as well as ecclesiastical power in the world, and they still do today. So they seek to compete against the major powers to control the world, ostensibly for God, but really for self, just like the Jews. Most of the Jews wanted to control the world for themselves, not so much for God. He was just the excuse. They ignored oftentimes biblical doctrines ignored or restated, or it's read, or it's reinterpreted in light of what you want it to to say, and you seek to impose Christian values via morality by force, which is not biblical. God doesn't use force to make people believe. You don't believe? He routinely does not send people against you to destroy you and beat you up. He lets you go. Now, if you attack his people, that's probably in the Old Testament, that was another issue. But you can attack Christians all day long. All you do is just send us to Jesus quicker. America has been just as guilty of genocide in the 20th century as those who it fought against. Public education has buried this for most people. Americans tend to think they're exceptional, they're different. Probably more gifted liars, probably more easily deluded. But no, we have a very dark, sinister backstory. The Christians need to adopt the same attitude as Jeremiah and Habakkuk. Trouble is coming. Accept God's judgment and live by faith in Him alone. Thank you.